Hello, meat friends. Welcome to the Regenerative Meat Podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Tice, and today Frank and I sit down with Brandon Uhl, our head brewer, and talk about Frank's adventure to Scotland that he recently just got back from. We start off the conversation talking about the meadery he visited in Scotland and the mead he brought back from it. Then we move into the history of mead and the Celtic culture and dive into some historical stories and uses of mead within that culture and other cultures that existed before today's modern era. Now let's get into it.
Hey everyone! Here at Golden Coast Mead, we consider drinking alcohol not only a luxury, but a celebration of life. If you partake in this celebration, we advocate for drinking regenerative mead made from real honey to help shift the $1.5 trillion alcohol industry in a better direction. When you drink our regenerative mead, you are helping to make the earth healthier, more biodiverse, and abundant. Drop monoculture-based booze and drink regenerative mead! Visit our website, www.goldencoastmead.com, to learn more about our regenerative mead business and be a part of the celebration. Cheers.
Slunchigens!
What are you pouring here, Frank?
I've got some Scottish mead, spruce mead from the rookery. My friend Christopher made it. I'm going to be using this accent the whole time. And if you don't like it, you can skive off. It's a Scottish mead made in, Perthshire, which is up in the kind of northeast central part of Scotland, about an hour and a half northeast of Glasgow.
The Highlands?
Not quite the Highlands. Depending on where you are, I can't do it anymore. Okay.
I knew you were going to do it the whole time. No way.
You tried.
Yeah,
made it 45 seconds.
I just got back from Scotland, and it was epic. And we got to drink Scottish mead with the Scottish mead maker, Christopher, who runs the rookery. And he's a Scottish Army veteran and a really rad guy. So this is a spruce mead, which has some Scottish heather honey in it. And he ferments it with a distiller's yeast, gets up to 17% alcohol, and they use spruce tips, like evergreen, kind of pine needles in the fermentation. So here it is, and cheers. Wish you all could drink this. If you go to Scotland, look up the rookery.
For sure.
We're going to be talking about Scottish mead.
We can give them the address too, because it's
on the back of the bottle. That's right. 2/3 Stable Cottage. PH 10 7PD. That's all it says. That's the address.
Put it in Google Maps.
If you do search for the rookery mead, Scotland, it does pop right up on Google Maps and drops you off in his courtyard of his old estate stable, which is like a barn where he makes the mead.
It's not Scottish Maps over there.
Scottish Maps. Aye. Okay, sorry. What were your questions?
What does it smell like to you? I get this.
Yeah, go for it.
Nice, sweet honey, sprucey, like evergreen tree. No, when I smell it?
Yeah, like walking through an evergreen forest.
Mm-hmm. Like it's wintertime almost.
Yeah. What do you get, Brandon?
I think it's herbal.
Herbal.
Kind of clover-ish. It's not resiny. It's not like a resiny spruce. It's more like the green kind of... makes me think of plant matter rather than like sap.
Yeah, totally. It's like so harmonious. There's just this constant greenness, but it doesn't go over ever. Mm-hmm. And I'm interested to see, I have one more bottle of this and we flew back with it just a couple days ago. So all the vibration and stuff on the travels have probably shaken apart the molecular compounds that I tasted at his house or / meadery. So it's a little less integrated and rich than I remember it, but it's kind of to be expected after traveling that much. So proper drinking protocol is to let a mead lay down for a couple weeks, like 2 weeks at least, after you travel with it, to hopefully give those molecules that have shaken apart some chance of grabbing back onto each other. So hopefully when we revisit this, it'll be even more rich and integrated.
But right now, I think it's drinking delicious.
I agree. I also get like super caramel notes and super smooth, in my opinion, too, to add to that.
Yeah. And the alcohol piece is there, right? There's a little bit of that spicy phenolic alcohol, but it's clean, super clean.
Especially for a 17%.
Yeah, like 17% isn't even noticeable.
Yeah, so. It's definitely not boozy.
Not boozy at all.
And the sweetness, you know, is really, you know, noticeable, but it like carries with it so much other flavors that it, like earlier, like I got like tropical fruits and melon and cantaloupe, and then, but that's balanced by the herbaceous quality. So it's like, there's so much going on, but it's all like pretty intense.
So talking about our mean stool, the sweetness is probably the longest leg, but the alcohol and then the tannin acid aspect of the spruce just creates this dynamic that is just continuously unfolding, right?
Yeah. And it's holding up that sweetness very well.
Yeah.
Even though it's the longer part of the stool.
Yeah, definitely. And literally in terms of length, like the sweetness is the thing that's carried into the finish. Where there's, you know, there's a kind of transition, you smell it, you taste it, and there's a few flavors that kind of come and go, and that sweetness is just there the whole time.
It's the through line. Yeah. I would say in the midpoint, the sweetness takes back seat to the alcohol and spruce dynamic, but then boom, like you're saying, that sweetness just finishes through.
All right, so you want to speak to your experience with mead in Scotland?
Oh man, it was so rad. So this guy isn't just a mead maker, he's run a meadery for 8 years after getting out of the Royal Army, but he was a anthropology and Gaelic scholar. So he like really focused on ancient Celtic culture in Scotland and throughout Europe. So his awareness of how mead factored into human life pre-Roman times was just like so rad, because I'm deeply fascinated by this, right? Like human history before modern culture has layers to it that are just like so fascinating. Like reading some of the transcendental philosophers, right, like Emerson and Thoreau, who kind of helped revolutionize American culture by saying like there's something beyond religion that all humans have access to, and like we don't have to be religious, but we can tap into states of being that make life really beautiful and not just about survival.
Mm-hmm.
And in my awareness, the Romans kind of spread their empire around the world and like grouped people into two classes, like the people that owned and ran shit, and then everybody else.
Mm-hmm.
And like, if you're not willing to like toe our line and learn our language and like run the empire and pay your taxes to us, we're going to subjugate you and turn you into everybody else. Mm-hmm. But like in the Celtic world, which spanned from like Turkey, right, in the east, throughout all of continental Europe, like Eastern Europe, like Southern Eastern Europe, because then it gets like pretty Germanic when you go up into like Germanic areas. So like through France to part Northern Italy, France, Spain, and then to the British Isles, and then even up a little bit north of France along the coast. Like this Celtic culture conceptualizes all people as free people. Though, as he would say, because he's like such a good scholar, he's like, yeah, what we actually know about the Celts is very hard. Like if someone wrote a 5-page book about the Druids, which was like their priest caste, when I was going to school, we would say that all 5 pages were conjecture. Now we would say that maybe 2 pages were legit and 3 pages were conjecture. So he was super solid as a storyteller in saying what we know for sure and then what we kind of imagine based off what
it kind of sounds like. Vikings though, where everyone was like their own,
a free person.
Yeah,
well, Vikings only I guess like popped up in like the 800s, right?
Mm-hmm.
So there was some exchange between the Germanic people and the Celtic people in contrast to the Roman people.
Mm-hmm.
And so like we're looking at this huge multi-thousand period of time, year period of time. But yes, like that idea that every human had within them
some capacity to direct their own reality. And it was in opposition to the Roman kind of, here's the hierarchy that runs things and here's everyone else. Mm-hmm. Is deeply fascinating for me, because I think that's like hopefully our path towards solving the problems that we have inherited as a world, is like all of us saying, enough with this bullshit, let's change it. And I like brought that up within 5 minutes of meeting Chris, and over the next 3 hours, like we talked around the whole thing for a long, beautiful time, and drank all like 20 different kinds of mead in small doses. Like literally he was pouring me like a 1 ounce cup half full each time, which was wise, because his meads don't spoil. Like he is like, oh yeah, I've had the same bottles open in my bar for 4 years and they're still delicious. And I just tell people, drink them within 2 years and keep them in a cool, dark place and they'll be fine. So he can like have samples in his showroom that he just sticks the pop top back on and then pours for people. But like at the beginning, I was like, I believe that because there's a traditional indigenous mead culture in like every continent around the world, except for Australia and Antarctica, that like humans can come together over this tradition and like share what they love about the world and the place that the honey comes from and the mead comes from. And through this, like we create a global culture that is joyful and sharing based. And he's like, yeah, I'm a lot more cynical than that. I was like, fair enough.
We need both of them.
Yeah. And then after 3 hours, we ended up giving each other a hug. And I told him he should charge a lot more for his amazing mead. And he said, no, I want the common man to be able to drink it. So it was pretty cool. He was putting his money where his mouth was. And his work where his mouth was, because the guy runs the show like basically by himself and he like has family members help him out, but he has zero employees.
Wow. So yeah. What are some interesting things you learned from him about like the history of the mead over there?
Dude, I wished I could record him, because it was just so thorough. Like his knowledge was so deep and expansive, but also like backed by actual research and scholarly articles. One of the things that's really cool is the Celtic bell beaker culture. Have you guys heard about this?
No.
I know, it's like, no one knows about this, but like, it's so rad. There's this culture that spread from like Eastern Spain, north of there, maybe where the Basque people are now, and east of there. And they like had these pottery vessels that were shaped in like a bell and like a beaker with like a thin narrow neck, and then they were inscribed with this cool like scrolled designs, and featured in some burial mounds are these like people that had gold and weapons and stuff in their burial mounds, so they were probably leaders of some kind, and they're like surrounded by these like drinking vessels that like have these residues of like these fermented super beverages, like honey, grains, fruit, all in one. But then you also find in the midden heaps, you know, which are like the trash piles, remnants of these beakers, same style, same shape, but just like tossed out in the trash. So he's like, okay, does that mean that the vessel was the important part or the liquid within it? And he's like, I think it's the liquid within it. Like you want to send your ancestors off to the afterlife with this drink. Mm-hmm. And so you bury them with the vessel full of the drink. So this drink was very special, and it spread like quickly from the place where it originated throughout the Celtic world. Mm-hmm. And it kind of defines like, okay, we knew that all these people were Celtic and had some kind of trade and language in common, because the speed at which this mm-hmm. technology and pottery and probably drink spread across the world.
So it had all types of different sugars, like it had honey, grain.
Gosh, man, I'm only like a week and a half out from visiting him. We visited him the Monday, so like 10 days ago, and like we covered so much ground that it's already getting a little fuzzy, and I wish that we could interview him, but my understanding is it kind of varied depending on where it was. But like the overarching cultural importance and constituent parts were similar. And it kind of united this whole Celtic world with this product. So that was pretty cool.
That's interesting.
Yeah. What other things were super interesting? We talked about spruce mead and that there is archaeological evidence of spruce being used in meads like 2,000 plus years ago. And it may have had some shamanic and medicinal qualities to it, but they might have added other things to it, like fly algeric mushrooms, which are like toadstools, you know, like the red toadstool mushrooms.
Oh, really?
Yeah. That like the Sami people still
do those use. Get you high or something?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, okay.
They're, like maybe that's where Santa Claus came from, that yeah. like people would eat the mushrooms and then see visions of this red suited being that would show up and make their life better.
I haven't heard that scene of origin story.
So how you said there might have been mushrooms in it? How confident?
Well, he's like, you know, in the archaeological record, a lot of the original sites were like cleaned, like the pochards were cleaned, mm-hmm. so we can't do the analysis on them. But there are some where there are like the ergot in Spain. And he was saying that ergot is like a fruiting mushroom. That like if you
grows
leave
on
it
grain
or, glows on yeah. grain. Yeah, and like St. Elmo's fire, like if your grain gets crop gets spoiled by ergot and then you brew beer out of it, like people can trip and it can uh-huh. be good or bad or uh-huh. heaven or hell. Turns out that if those spores on the grain that turn it purple are left long enough, they turn into a mushroom. Uh-huh. Which is pretty wild.
So the Celts were on mushrooms.
Or like LSD.
Yeah.
LSD. Yeah.
or that's both. Explained.
I can see why that would, because alcohol already existed. Fermented drinks already existed. But it seems like this one type of drink kind of spread like Saint, what was it again?
Saint Elmo's fire.
Saint Elmo's fire. Spread like fire. And because if it had some psychoactive ingredient in it, then people would probably want to
participate in that.
Yeah.
And I mean, we started talking about the immortality key, which is the, have I talked about this
a little
with you
bit?
Guys?
Yeah. Yeah.
Not really.
Earlier today, I think you mentioned
it. So the immortality key is a book that was published in the last year by a guy named Brian Marchescu. And it's pretty popular right now, but, he was like a Latin, Greek and Sanskrit scholar. And he learned about the pagan continuity hypothesis, which is this idea that like religion can be traced back to these pagan people who used religious rites to like teach each other important things like agriculture, like how to practice agriculture. So through these myths and these rituals, the things that you needed to do to plant the grain and create the harvest were like ritualized and taught every year through the participation in these rituals. And he's like, but at some point it went from being this kind of culture defining practice to this kind of like just formalized thing that you went through, and it lost its like magical power. And that was some point prior to modernity as we know it, where like Christianity started to come on the scene and these rituals went from being like life-changing experiences to kind of being these cultural things that were continued to carry on but didn't like change people's lives anymore. Mm-hmm. So we wondered why that was, and there are some scholars in the 70s who were like, well, that was when we stopped using psychedelics in the rituals. And the mainstream academia having like been kind of burned by the electric Kool-Aid acid test and like that whole culture that was like, you know, just do the drugs, it'll be fine. And I was like, actually, if you have schizophrenia or some kind of like destabilizing mental condition and you do the drugs, you will go crazy and you won't come back. You know, we didn't really understand that at that point. So it was pretty irresponsible. And so academia was like, smush it all down. But then in the last 10 years, Johns Hopkins, UCLA, NYU have like been showing how psilocybin can like change people's experience of end of life anxiety. They get like a life ending diagnosis, and then they do mushrooms with a psychiatrist, and they have a totally transformational experience. And the last 6 months of their life is like the most beautiful time in their reality. Mm-hmm. Or they're addicted to something like nicotine, and like 70% of the time one dose of psilocybin with a psychiatrist will get them off of it, whereas like the next best thing is like 10% effective. So
And then PTSD is like another use case.
Depression too, right?
Yeah. So there's these potential for these like illegal drugs to be transformational if they're used the right way. And Brian, the author of this book, has never done psychedelics, but he's like, I think that something's missing here. Like, how could something have been important to humanity from time immemorial up through the Romans, and then all of a sudden it like gets like excised from our culture? So I'm talking about this with Chris, our Scottish mead maker, and he's like, oh, I haven't heard about this book. And I'm like, well, I think mead was like the thing, like the potion. And in Greece, there was this drink called the Kaikion, where 3,000 people would drink it at one time, and then their lives would be changed. And like huge figures within Roman and Greek culture talk about the transformational power of this ritual, which included this mysterious potion that we don't know the recipe of. But the author, Brian Marchescu, goes to Spain to this site, which is an offshoot of the Greek sites, and like finds a skull that has plaque on the molars that is ergot, which is the LSD-like substance that was probably in these potions. So there's a lot of room to conjecture that humanity was sharing these technologies with each other, and in this way, experiencing those gnosis-creating events that, you know, theoretically don't leave you if you integrate them the right way in your life. And he was like, yeah, I haven't ever done them myself, but the evidence does suggest that they existed thoroughly. And then during the Inquisition, the people that made them got smushed out by the Inquisitors because, like, this was witchcraft and therefore not acceptable. So it's pretty fascinating.
And that's why everyone's depressed now?
Well, you know, I mean, I think if we go back to that Roman conceptualization of reality where there's like the super wealthy who maintain the empire and then everyone else, a lot of parallels could be made to our reality. And like, if you haven't figured out like why you're here on Earth and what your thing is that makes life worth living, then it can get pretty depressing, right?
Yeah. And mead and shrooms help with that a lot.
Well, shrooms, I think, are... I know mead does. I know that when I drink mead with people, it gets a lot more fun and a lot more playful. And like, as my wife recently said, of course there is suffering in this life, but there's also immeasurable beauty. And I think that that is easier to see when you've had a glass or two of mead with friends. But mushrooms can do that too. If it's the right set and setting, right? And like, yeah. If you don't pay attention, if you don't have a healthy respect for them and you just do them willy-nilly, there's a chance that you think you can fly and you jump off something and you end up dying.
That's
so
very true.
It's important to have the intention set and the setting where you're going to be safe. And if anything sketchy comes up, because it can just manifest the deepest parts of our subconscious. And if there's something down there that's gnarly and you don't have someone helping you go, well, why is that there? What does it have to teach you? Like, it's going to keep showing up until you're like, fuck, this sucks.
So do you think there's something special about brewing mead with the grain that has that
ergot fungus
on it that's special only to mead and that grain?
Mm.
And like, that's why that was the combination of most of the drinks. I know those are variations, but...
And they are. And to be accurate, our understanding of the Kaikion now is that it was grain and mint and water. So while progenitors might have had honey, and they definitely used honey at Eleusis to pour out offerings for the other priestesses and gods, the Kaikion, as we understand it at this point, was grain and mint and water.
Gotcha.
But there are, I think there's like recent written evidence of fly algeric mushrooms in mead, which is like for sure a psychedelic potion.
Okay.
Yeah. And do I think that there's a dynamic between there? You know, I've never experimented with mushrooms in mead.
So you can't really speak to it?
Mm-hmm.
Do you want me to experiment for you? I'll be your taster.
I don't know if we should talk about this.
Fair enough. fair enough.
I mean, California is supposed to decriminalize it, but it's still a Schedule I substance, so to be responsible.
If you say so.
Yeah.
All right. Is there anything else interesting you learned from him?
Jeez. what were some other really interesting things? Up in, like, northern Scotland, where, like, Celtic culture is still alive. Like, there are still people who speak Gaelic in northern Scotland. There are sites where Mead and, like, the monolith astrological circles were found together. So, like, early Celtic people gathering around these stones that tracked the sun and the movement of the sun on and relative to the earth, and drinking mead, like, that happened for sure thousands of years ago. So knowing that, like, that reality was really factual and that people were doing that, and that when we drink mead, we're tying into that whole thing that didn't get written down. Like, those weren't literate people. So their whole systems of belief were all oral. And when the Romans documented it, they were documented it from, like, these people are barbarians and our enemy. so they weren't exactly characterizing
it. A little skewed.
Yeah, they weren't exactly giving them the rosy side of the picture. But those people existed. Mead was a part of their traditions and way of understanding the world. And that really speaks to me because, like, when you just look at a glass of mead, there are 200,000 flower visits in there.
That makes sense. So I think an interesting question would be, why do you think mead fell off? It feels like mead just kind of disappeared. And wine and beer kind of skyrocketed. Is there, like, any historical suggestions as to why that happened? Or what's your view on that, I guess?
That's really interesting. And I was literally talking to Ken Tram about that today, about how probably over the course of human history, the amount of beer and wine and mead that got produced was, like, within relative ranges, right? They were the celebratory beverages that you made when you had, like, plenty of something. And during different parts of human history, like, if you focus on the Roman Empire, there's probably been more wine. If you focus on, I don't know where, like, the Germanic Empire, there was maybe more beer. But if you focus on, like, Poland and Ethiopia, there's probably more mead because, like, those cultures valued them and, like, had intact systems of mead production. So taking all of human history and, like, balancing it out, before horse-drawn agriculture, there was probably a relatively equal amount of beer, wine, and mead, and it was all pretty special, right? Mm-hmm. And then when we get, like, horses and the harness and the plow, the ability to grow grapes and grain, well, the ability to grow grain specifically, like, skyrockets. And then the ability to grow grapes increases. But, like, honey is something that people need to hand do. So you can almost mechanize these other two and increase the proportion of beer and wine in the world hugely. And then by the time that mechanized agriculture comes around with tractors and, you know, threshers and automatic harvesting, where, like, one human can harvest 100 acres in a day, it's like beer blows away mead, then grapes catch up in the 50s when they, like, are able to create these special machines that can, like, walk, you know, drive down the aisle of grapes and just, like, suck the grapes off of the stems, you know. And now, like, large-scale commercial quality wine can be made at a fraction of the labor that it takes to make mead. So now mead becomes this, like, specialized niche within a sea of mechanized alcohol and agriculture. So Schramm's point was, like, not so much that mead was common at one point and went down, but instead they were all uncommon and the other two skyrocketed and relative mind share of mead totally reduced.
Interesting.
Was distilled mead ever a thing?
Great question. I'm not sure if distilled mead was ever a thing. I know it's been made and I know it can be really good. But if you think about, like, the value in a bottle right? Like honey is the most expensive fermentable sugar by a factor of 4 to 7. Yes,
for those reasons of not like, being easily scaled, you know.
You need hand labor to make it. Mm-hmm. So every time that someone touches, you know, an input or a product, the price goes up. And with honey, you have to touch it at every stage of the game. You can't just have a machine touch it, right? So distilling it results in very expensive alcohol, but it can be very good.
Mm-hmm. So distilling happened around the 17...
I've heard the 1400s, right? It goes from Arabia in the 1400s through Spain.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, they invented it originally, like the genie in a bottle. That was because they had like these different spirits, and then you're in a tent in the middle of the desert, and you open this bottle, and like, holy shit, the party just got crazy. Put that genie back in that bottle. And like, they were also experimenting with all kinds of plants, right? There was no prescription on what was legal and what was not. And so all kinds of things ended up into the spirit. And so it was like cannabis plus ethanol equals one experience versus like henbane and ethanol equals a wholly different experience. And like, yeah, crazy. So, carpets started flying.
You think maybe the mechanized like capability of grain and grapes happening around the same time that distillation became widespread is why mead never like was on that wave. It just, it's too expensive, and it was sort of becoming less and less common by the time the world was becoming more industrialized.
Yeah, so you don't have enough of it to distill. You don't have enough of it because it costs more, and like honey in and of itself is already worth doing, so why do the extra labor when you can drink beer and wine? But now we know that mead is better.
So what I hear you saying is engineers need to invent a robot bee that can pollinate,
or a robot harvesting system. Like when Shram was talking about this, I was like kind of imagining like you take your hive and you stick it in this like vacuum that gently sucks all the bees off of it, pulls apart the hive, takes out the comb, scrapes it, spins it, puts it back together, sticks the bees back on there, and then poop, out the other end is like an empty beehive. Well, a beehive that's empty of honey but full of bees, and no human has had to like take that hive, take it apart, cut the comb off, extract the honey, put it back together, put the bees back in it. You know, that's what we're doing now. It's like a human does all of those steps. So what if, it seems possible, right? If you machined all the stuff the right way.
We're humans. We can engineer anything.
Yeah, that's true. Would the bees like it? I mean, if you gently sucked them off and like fed them while they were waiting to get their hive back, and then 10 minutes later spat them back out, you know, gently blew them back into the hive. Imagine you get enough of them back in there and you like maintain the brood colony, right? Because that's where the queen and the baby bees are. So like, leave that alone.
I think if I go down that rabbit hole in my head, my concern is I know humans will take it too far. Most like they do with bees. Animals, like with cows.
Well, you end up shooting yourself in the foot if you destroy the 60,000 bees that make up the hive, right? Like all the energy that's gone into making that macro organism, right? It's a super organism. Like, yes, there's the individual bee, but the hive only exists because all the little pieces work together.
But it might be cheaper to buy new bees.
Well, there are people that used to do that in Canada. They would kill their bees at the end of every season.
Really?
Yeah.
Yikes.
Yeah. And it's not legal anymore, one. Two, everyone is like, you're a terrible person. So mostly people don't do it. But I just, I don't think we're in a place where that's okay.
Yeah.
Anymore.
I have a question about, is there anything special, or maybe not special, but particular about the climate or the soil in Scotland that makes Scottish mead different than like mead made in, you know, Spain or whatever?
Well, heather honey is like this specifically special thing. And up in the Highlands, as I understand it, the ecosystem, like rather than having grass, they have this peat.
It's like moss, right?
Yeah. And it's everywhere. It's like you go walk on the hillsides, and instead of there being dirt on the hills like there is here, or grass on the hills like there are in the Midwest, it's like this layer of spongy, it's not quite moss. It's like a low growing bush.
Yeah.
That's super spongy.
Isn't it used for something? I feel like it's
peat fires, right?
Like, yeah, like it was fire. Yeah. Okay.
And then smoking barley and then making it into,
that's what it was.
Yeah.
Okay.
Making it into whiskey. So in that part of the world, heather is this flowering plant that grows amongst the peat. And the honey that can come from that is just like so uniquely delicious. And there's a little bit of it in this mead, which gives it like that citrusy quality and that herbal, spicy, slightly mentholated characteristic that I think adds a ton of complexity and deliciousness to this mead. But he only uses it as like a portion of his honey bill.
I know this is probably going to be a very broad topic, but with beer brewing, the temperature, the season, the location has a big effect in terms of like, even if before people knew yeast existed and, you know, weren't controlling the temperature of fermentation, it was sort of up to the season. And so certain styles could be brewed certain parts of the year or certain parts of the world.
Right.
And not others. So with mead, like you can, you know, talk about Scotland in particular or anywhere else is like, and you were mentioning they were using these giant stones to like track the sun. Were there certain styles of mead that they could brew at certain parts of the year that otherwise they couldn't?
That's a great question. So I didn't talk about this with Chris as much as I should have because the moons, right, there's 13 moon cycles in a 364-day year. And the solar cycle is like 365 to 366, depending on leap year, right? So, like, there is a way to reconcile the solar calendar and the lunar calendar, but you have to be accurate enough. Otherwise, it gets super wobbly, right? You have to adjust those 1 to 2 days every year. So 28 days marks a lunar cycle, right? From full moon is 28 days. So that's 4 7-day weeks. And 13 28-day months, multiply that out, that's 364 days. So
Seems simpler?
Yeah. Well, it's crazy. Like, why is 13 an unlucky number? Because the Catholic Church, under the influence of the Roman Empire, wanted to convert the whole world to a solar calendar. Because it does link the whole world together, right? Like we loop the sun once a year if we're paying attention to 365 days. But depending on where you are in the world, the moon is different, right? What that moon tells you to do agriculturally and horticulturally is different based off your growing season. And so like in northern climates, you're like catching fish and hunting game. Whereas in central climates, you're planting different crops and harvesting different crops. So like having a global system based off of the same calendar is a lot harder when that organizing principle is that different.
Yeah.
Well, in the like Celtic world, the moon that we're in right now at midsummer is the mead moon. And it's when you drink the mead that is available and everyone gets married. And it lasts the whole moon cycle. And like on midsummer, like you have this big group wedding where everyone who wants to get married gets married, and then they all drink a ton of mead, and then for the rest of the moon, they're drinking mead together, and it's the honeymoon. It's pretty crazy where the honeymoon comes from.
Wait, is that
apocryphal or true?
No. Well, is that is that like researchable or is that a theory?
No, like on honeymoon
origins.
It was the mead moon. They got married on midsummer.
Okay,
and they drank mead for like the whole time.
Huh.
So then honeymoon became this term that like is contested of like there's a good period and a bad period after you get married. But at its earliest,
well, when you stop drinking mead, it's obviously bad.
Exactly. And it is, right? Like you're getting drunk and having babies, and then you got to raise them babies, and that's a lot more work. The honeymoon is over.
Yeah.
But like hopefully a healthy society knows how to deal with this, you know. And the moon after the mead moon is the wort moon in those traditions. So that's when you then harvest that honey and you then make it into the mead, which will then ferment over the next 12 moons for the next mead moon. Like, that's so cool to me. Hopefully that answers your question.
Yeah. Well, could you go maybe more, I guess some of this isn't known because it wasn't recorded, but like were there styles of mead that could only be made in Scotland that maybe couldn't be made in Ireland because of
temperature and
temperature or just what yeast. Flowers are available. You know, like I know like some of Scotland is really cold. So they use a beer analog, like in Germany, they would brew a lot of lagers because it gets really cold in Germany. So if you are brewing beer, but you don't know that yeast exists, the yeast that's thriving in your beer and fermenting is lager yeast, you know, or, you know, maybe not technically lager yeast, but it maybe became lager yeast over time. And so with mead brewing, is there any record of like, you know, we could only brew this during the winter because when we try and brew this mead during the summer, it just tastes terrible?
That's a great question. So I think they only brewed it once a mm-hmm. year, mm-hmm. but I guess they had this mead stick that hung in the kitchen mm-hmm. and it just collected the microorganisms that mm-hmm. were floating mm-hmm. around the kitchen. And then you like stirred each batch with it. Mm-hmm. So you'd be picking up like the leavings from prior batches and it would be caking on mm-hmm. and then it would be drying out and then you'd be like reintroducing it to the next wort. Mm-hmm. So by making it like once a year, you're probably doing it during a certain time when a certain temperature range is available. Mm-hmm. And then you're selecting yeasts that are already around that microclimate as it exists, right? But to your point about like different, I hear you kind of asking, are there different styles based off of location? Mm-hmm. Like a wit beer or mm-hmm. a Hefeweizen might be produced in the same place as a lager, but just at different times of year,
right?
Like lager when it's cold and then Hefeweizen wit beer when it's warmer. Right. And maybe that plays into like mead was for special events mm-hmm. and it was only made once mm-hmm. versus beer was more for every day. And so you had different recipes for different times of year based also off the grain bill, right? Mm-hmm. Those are different grain bills.
Right. Yeah.
Based off of like in the peak of summer, the wit beer grain bill is
like a lot of wheat and, you know,
way less barley.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Whereas in the winter, you're going to have barley saved and you're going to be able to malt it and then you're going to be able to ferment it. Mm-hmm. Right.
So can we talk about then why they only did it once a year? Do you think there's a reason behind that?
Probably because honey is only available in surplus at that peak of summer when
the bees are going out.
Yeah.
That's interesting. So it's only right now, generally speaking, where honey is at its highest.
Oh my gosh. As Ian Smith, the beekeeper at Ballater, which is where Balmoral Castle is, we heard him say, on a bonny blinky day. A bonny blinky day, what do you mean? Well, you know, when it's bonny out and it's quite bright, so you're blinking all the time. Then's the time tarps, dear honey.
That's time. That's interesting. So that's literally just when they had a surplus of honey to brew the mead. And yeah. then that mm-hmm. usually got them through the year.
I think so. I mean, again, that's like Chris would say, we're totally conjecturing. There's no hard archaeological or written evidence. We're taking like a lot of pieces and kind of like triangulating to like a feasible conclusion. But we're not sure about that. And my wife was like, you know, I really respected him for it. I felt way more comfortable getting to that point in the story because it wasn't like he was telling me something that wasn't legit. He was laying out some things and then saying, these are the conclusions we draw from it. If you want to draw them too, great. If not, that's okay. Because it's not certain.
Yeah. Just like most things in life.
You know, I'm certain that this meat is delicious and you guys are awesome.
All right, that's a wrap on Frank's journey to Scotland. Please don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review us. We appreciate all the support we can get. If there is anything you'd like to know more about, feel free to email us at podcast@goldencoastmead.com with your questions and we'll try to answer them to the best of our ability for you. Now here's your weekly bee joke. How does a bee know when he's found his honey? His heart beats faster. Mead out.